No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show, which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. Along with my co-host, Maria Sanchez, we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So join in the discussion by calling in at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Or you can Skype us at BBSRADIO and the number 1. We have a very special guest tonight, C.R. Gibbs, a noted historian and author who's going to talk to us about a myriad of things. We're going to discuss Emancipation Day, the only official holiday in the District of Columbia, and some D.C. history, and actually whatever Mr. Gibbs wants to talk about. So without further ado, let me introduce my co-host, Maria Sanchez. Maria, are you there?
I am here. Hi, Michael. How was your week?
It was okay. It was very busy with Emancipation Day celebrations. Emancipation Day coincided with the Cherry Blossom Festival this year, so it was very, very active for the last few days. And on the statehood front, we've had a lot of interesting things happen. First of all, we want to give a shout out to Representative Brendan Boyce, a Democrat from Pennsylvania's 13th District, who became the 150th co-sponsor on our statehood bill. That's more co-sponsors than we've ever had on a statehood bill. And it's about a third, almost a third, of the members of both houses of Congress. So we're moving right along. We're very thankful for that.
Michael, and is there a goal, a target goal for how many you need or want, or what purpose does it serve other than obviously give you momentum or help you?
That's it, momentum, because the Speaker of the House will not move our legislation, and so it can't go anywhere in this session. But our hope is that as we build more co-sponsors and more co-sponsors, we reintroduce the legislation in every Congress. So the hope is that sooner or later, we'll have enough co-sponsors that when it's reintroduced, we'll get enough people on board quick enough to get it passed. So, yes, it's all about momentum at this point. Yes.
How will you go about doing that after the next election and the new president is inaugurated? Is that the timing?
Yes, we'd have to have somebody willing to move the bill. Now, there's a brand new approach to this as introduced by the mayor at a breakfast for Emancipation Day the other day and on Friday. And hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about it at the end of the show. If not, we'll talk about it next week.
Okay.
It's somewhat detailed plan. I don't want to take away from C.R. Gibbs' time because Mr. Gibbs, you know, it's a real treat to have somebody like him on the show. So we get him on and talk about, maybe we can get some of his input too on the mayor's proposal to put this before the new Congress. It's all
nice.
Aimed at whenever we get a new Congress, which will be in November. It's only 8.5 months away. So without further ado, let me introduce, let's bring on C.R. Gibbs, noted historian and author. Mr. Gibbs, are you with us? Mr. Gibbs, are you there? Thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, I'm very pleased that you invited me.
Yeah. Can you tell us, let's start out by talking about Emancipation Day. I would explain Emancipation Day, except you could do it so much better than than I can. So I'll let you explain it. And it's really, I think it's really interesting that it's so unique. Can you tell our listeners what Emancipation Day is all about?
Sure. Simply put, D.C. Emancipation Day, April 16th, marks the 1862, marks the day at which President Lincoln signed a document ending slavery and providing for the only instance of compensated emancipation in the history of the United States. By it, approximately 3,100 enslaved people of African descent were henceforth and forever freed from the shackles of slavery. If I could, I would have folk understand that, as imperfect as D.C. emancipation may be in retrospect, it helped to put the nation on a freedom road. And what I mean by that is we have D.C. emancipation on April 16, 1862. The success of that emboldened Lincoln to then, in June of 1862, end slavery in the Western Territories. Then in September of 1862, Lincoln issues the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation. Then January 1st, the Emancipation Proclamation takes effect. June of 1865, we have Juneteenth. And then in December of 1865, we have the passage of the 13th Amendment. So I believe that this freedom road begins with D.C. emancipation, and it has an extraordinary impact on regional developments, for it is November the 1st, 1864, that Maryland abolishes slavery by a change in its constitution. So I think that what we can see is that the death knell of slavery in the Citadel of the Union, which took 30 years. This is nothing that happened, you know, with the magical buddy didn't just strike President Lincoln. This was a result of the activities of people of African descent and progressive whites who were repulsed at the just outrageous scenes of slavery and violence and blood that occurred daily in the nation's capital. And so their effort was finally crowned on April 16th, 1862.
By a Republican, Maria. I just want to add that, you know, because I get
thank
as
you.
As a Democrat, I beat Maria up sometimes because she's a Republican. but yes, he was a great Republican. Can you quickly? I'll let Maria ask a question in a second. But can you explain to us what Juneteenth is? Because I know it's a big holiday for many African Americans, but I don't think that most of America understands what it is.
Juneteenth honors June 19th, 1865, when Union troops landed in Galveston, Texas. And it's not, and I need to just clear up a couple of things. We have these wonderful myths and crazy stories that the messenger was killed on the way to Texas, and you know, passenger pigeons were shot down and what have you. And while it, you know, it may make good copy, none of that is true. We still had newspapers, we had the telegraph, we had steamboats. So it wasn't that black people or whites, for that matter, in Texas didn't know. Texas is clearly listed in the Emancipation Proclamation. It was just that Texas, the Texans weren't inclined to do it without being forced to do it. And it is the arrival of Union soldiers in Galveston on June 19, 1865, and the issuance of General Order Number 3 that formally ends slavery in what was then the largest state in the Union, and festivities ensued in Texas.
Imagine people in Texas being reluctant to comply.
To celebrate.
Yeah. Go ahead, well, Maria. I'm sorry.
What I kind of find odd is, since the day is so great in our country's history, why we don't honor it as a nation.
It is that has puzzled a number of people, but we know that there have been, almost since its beginning, forces that sought to end or change D.C. emancipation. For example, Booker T. Washington in 1915 came into D.C. and suggested to the local black community leaders that we get on board with January 1st, the day of the Emancipation Proclamation issuance. But the most of the elders in D.C. said, no, we're not going to do that. We didn't know in April of 1862 if the North would triumph. Everything was obscured by cannon fire and the smoke of black powder weapons, so we didn't know. But in part because of that, and in part because there was a move, for example, 100 years ago, partly because I believe of the influence of Washington, there were people who wanted to celebrate September 22nd, the date of the preliminary emancipation. But in the heart of the community, April 16th remained sacrosanct, nearly. And but it also suffered from a lack of publicity, and people were also in every other state celebrating their own special day. So that we have every November 1st since 1864 in Maryland, there have been traditional celebrations. And for example, in Laurel, Maryland, which is just across the border from D.C. And if anyone is familiar with Route 50 going from D.C. or Maryland toward the beaches, Ocean City, Rehoboth, Dewey, there is a place that is just, if Maria, if you blink, you'll miss it. But it's a town called Trapp, Maryland. And they have a celebration almost as old as the actual Maryland Emancipation Day called Uncle Nace's Day. And they keep it, they have quite a celebration from all accounts. So with many other localities celebrating their own Freedom Day, it appears that D.C. kind of got left in the lurch.
Well, am I
wrong
especially
about...
Go ahead, Maria. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, Michael. I was going to say, especially because it only became an official public holiday in January of 2005.
Yes, there was I personally was involved in the struggle. I wrote an article about the D.C. Emancipation Day Parade for the Washington Post back in 1985. So that's how long I've been aware and trying to illuminate people about it. But it's been a long battle. There were years when simply for the churches to have a celebration was an act of resistance in the face of a city council, a board of commissioners, and the Congress that were hostile to any expression of black resistance or independence.
Well, first, this is a perfect time to say that in addition to the advocacy of people like Mr. Gibbs, there's a lady that we should give a shout out to, Loretta Carter Haynes, who kept all the records and helped keep the holiday alive, at least in the memories of people in Washington, D.C. Ms. Haynes, unfortunately, I believe she's in her 90s now, couldn't be with us today because she's not feeling well, but we want to give her a shout out. And also Vincent Orange, Maria, is the guy who actually put in legislation that made this 11 years ago an official holiday with a parade in the District of Columbia. But am I wrong, CR? At one time, didn't the President of the United States actually march in Emancipation Day parades at the very beginning?
The custom was to visit the President at the White House, and he would basically look over the retinue and speak for a few minutes, and then the parade would move on. But I guess, you know, if I can use just Kennedy's old line about defeat is an orphan, but victory has 100 fathers.
Yeah.
A lot of people got on the D.C. Emancipation bandwagon because it was the premier event of the social season for African Americans. And there started to be two parades. And, and folks just said, look, the White House said, we're not getting in that. We're just not going to be involved. And it just went crazy. It sort of spiraled out of control after that, with a split along class lines within the black community. And although the celebration would recover and continue almost unabated until the 1950s, before it hit a long low.
And what was that about? Apathy? Yeah.
And again, a lack of knowledge. I can give you what to me sort of symbolizes it. In D.C., there is a primarily white organization called the Organization of Oldest Inhabitants. But there used to be a Organization of Oldest Inhabitants, comma, colored. When they died out, and many of them had been enslaved or their parents had, so the memory was fresh for them. But it wasn't passed on to the grandchildren and the great-grandchildren. It's not taught. It wasn't taught in the schools for decades. So the memory began to flicker and just about went out until 1962.
Wow, that's tragic.
Yeah.
Yes.
It really
yes,
is.
Yes.
Happened in 1962?
There is a congressional celebration, and that sort of wakes folks up. You mean we're only 100 years out of slavery, the nation's capital? Are you kidding me? And so there was a celebration on Capitol Hill. And so here and there, kind of like diamonds scattered on black velvet, there was a sparkle of a celebration here, and one there, and one there, and one widely separated over here. And so it built up slowly over time. Mrs. Haynes, God blesses her, is the caretaker. She is the historian of D.C. emancipation, and she takes it and goes with it, and the connection she makes with Vincent Orange is all destiny needs to jumpstart the process and get us the recognition that the holiday deserves.
Nice.
Well, you know, I've got to tell you that I saw some of the records that Loretta Carter Haynes had kept, and I was just amazed. Maybe you could talk about this a little bit, Mr. Gibbs, about how people were compensated for their slaves. I know that newborn babies were, you know, they were paid a few dollars for middle-aged women, whereas young, healthy men, people were compensated several thousand dollars for. I mean, it was just amazing for me to look at these records and see the disparity. So it wasn't like everybody got $100 for each slave. They were somehow valued. Didn't they bring in somebody to do a valuation of the slaves?
Like in an appraisal.
In the basically 966 petitions, there were the slave owners listed the names. I mean, it's an unparalleled source of biographical information for enslaved people in Washington, D.C. So they list the names. They list the value that the owner put on them. But it got to a point where they had a commission, and they brought in a slave dealer from Baltimore named Campbell. And so he has to go through these records. He has to interview in person the freedom-seeking black folk. He even, where he cannot make a good determination, examines their teeth so that an age-based determination can be made with respect to the value. And so you do have $25 for a two-month-old baby or $1,800 for a skilled male blacksmith. And in the case of the man who is the largest slave owner in the district, his name was George Washington Young. And his plantation was on the site of what is now Bowling Air Force Base. So he's right on the Anacostia River. He owns two tracts of land, Nonsuch and Geesboro. Geesboro, again, is the land along the Anacostia, roughly where the Bowling Air Force Base is. But his land goes up the hill. This would be, for those familiar with the D.C. area, from the Anacostia River up the hill up to Alabama and Branch. And that's the second tract of land, the Nonsuch tract of land, where one of his houses stood for many years. And depending upon the source, it may still stand in a modified form on Bangor Street Southeast, somewhere between the 35th and 37th 100 block.
Wow, that's I know Washington a little bit, and that's a lot of land.
That's a lot of land.
Yeah.
How many slaves did he have?
George Washington Young had 69. He had 69. So he got, he sought compensation on 69. He got $17,771 compensation for his loss. If you swing into about a dollar in 1862 is worth about 23 bucks today, that's over $400,000.
My goodness.
Yeah. So, and we know, and this is part of the hidden history, there were people who moved their enslaved black people out of the district on the eve of Lincoln's signing. But I suppose the revenge, if you can call it that, is once freedom came to D.C., the enslaved people from virtually every county in Maryland and Virginia flocked into the district. We know now from the newspaper accounts that for those listeners who know D.C. well enough to know the 11th Street Bridge connecting the Navy Yard with it, hundreds of enslaved people from Maryland would cross that bridge in the weeks leading up to D.C. emancipation. And it did not mean that they were automatically free. There's an extraordinary letter between Lincoln and one of his espionage chiefs. And what it talks about is that he tells Lincoln, there are the bodies of dead black people who were caught up in between the bounty hunters and trying to get their freedom almost within sight of the White House.
Well, let me ask you, this is something, and I don't know that you can even answer this question, Mr. Gibbs, if there's information about this, but how did the slave owners in the South feel about this, since D.C. was the only, am I right, it was the only compensated emancipation in our history? And I know the people in the South had enough reason to dislike Abraham Lincoln to begin with, but did they feel that they had gotten shortchanged because the people in D.C. had gotten paid and they didn't get paid?
Well, if I can sort of reverse that, if I can inverse that and uh-huh. say in December of 1862, again, in part because of the success of D.C. emancipation, and the listeners can find this in Basler's collections of the Papers of Lincoln, he makes three proposals to the Congress. One of them is to extend slavery until January 1900, if wow. essentially the South will consider compensated emancipation. Trust me, that got nowhere. Because from December of 1862, the South still feels it has a chance to win the war. That's not going anywhere. But it was consistent with Lincoln's ideas as early as Lincoln, when he came in from Illinois, had floated the idea of some form of emancipation in the district subject to the vote of white male citizens as early as 1849. So, you know, this had been a morning in his consciousness since that time. But the South wasn't on that road. Another indicator, there was a South Carolina newspaper that reports center front page about emancipation in the district, and there's no comment. It's just there, and that's it. They move on. Compensation's not going to work. The South is too committed to war, and with success still within its reach, they don't care about that now. That's not going to go. And it's a reminder that the Civil War in the United States is the only instance of enslaved people being freed by a large-scale war. The British Empire used compensated emancipation to let 800,000 enslaved African people go. The French used a form of compensated emancipation. Heck, even Mexico in 1829 had the legislation provide for some form of compensated emancipation. So the idea was not, and this is in 1829, when Vicente Guerrero is the president, and he has African descent as well as Native American descent, and he understands that we got to stop this system. But at the same time, America's quote-unquote manifest destiny is pressing him on his northern border. He will be assassinated, in part, we believe, because of the actions that he took. And the part of Mexico that will be known as Tejas, slavery will reassert itself, and that will become the Republic of Texas, the only political entity that walks right into the Union, that already has ambassadors in Washington, already has its own flag. It is an extraordinary example of the power of the slaveocracy to make its will manifest.
Wow.
So, Mr. Gibbs, mm-hmm. can you double back to, sure. you said it was a form of revenge that the owners took their slaves out of the District of Columbia, and I'm hoping somehow they got punished because they couldn't bring them back and get compensated?
I wish that had been true. Let me share with you a story told by Frederick Douglass's brother, Perry Downs. And it's not well known that Douglass had siblings, but he did. Perry found himself, of all places, in Texas when emancipation comes. And he overheard his master, and just to telescope the story, talking about moving his black folk. And it is that at that point, Perry Downs says, that he resolved to never go near water with his master. And we do know, and Senator Charles Sumner looked into this in Congress, that there were slave owners who left the United States to go to places like Cuba and Brazil where slavery still existed. And on the Internet today, you may find websites devoted to erected by the descendants of those Confederate slaveholders who moved to places about 100, 150 miles outside of Sao Paulo in Brazil, and they still have been known to occasionally fly the Confederate flag. So there were people who were dedicated to the maintenance of slavery and believed that had it not been for Lincoln, slavery would have continued to spread across certainly the Western Hemisphere, if not the world.
Wow.
Yeah, that's absolutely incredible. And, you know, when you talk about compensated emancipation, maybe that should be our new strategy with Congress. I think in reverse, we have compensated them for our freedom. I think we pay about $2 billion a year, $3 billion a year in federal taxes. So that ought to be enough compensation for them to let us go, but I don't think they're going to do that.
You bought your freedom over time.
Bought our freedom
in installments.
Yes, many times over. We're going to take a short break here, and we're going to play for you one of my favorite civil rights songs. It's I think Mr. Gibbs can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it goes back to slave times, and it's called Oh Freedom by the Golden Gospel Singers. We'll be back in a minute.
Oh freedom, oh freedom, oh freedom over me. I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free.
And we're back with Maria Sanchez and C.R. Gibbs, noted historian and author. I want to explain a little bit. C.R. has outlined Emancipation Day and how we got where we are today. And I just want to talk a minute about the celebration itself as it exists today. On Friday, first of all, everybody in America should understand that you don't have to pay your taxes until Monday, April 18th, because of Emancipation Day. So, if
yes,
you know
thank you very
in,
much.
Yes,
my
you know
CPA pointed that
district,
out to me.
If you know somebody in the District of Columbia, text them and say thank you, because it's because of us that you don't have to pay your taxes. But this year, we had an Emancipation Day breakfast hosted by the mayor. And this was a celebration where elected officials and people we call stakeholders in the statehood movement and other people get together, and we have a breakfast and we talk about the significance of Emancipation Day and what it you know, what it means to us moving forward. And this year we had several civil rights leaders who did a panel at the breakfast. Wade Henderson was one of them, and Congressman Claiborne from South Carolina, and there were others, and we discussed the civil rights movement and what we do with Emancipation Day moving forward. And appropriately enough, this was the breakfast was held at the Willard Hotel, which is a hotel in Washington where Abraham Lincoln actually stayed. So that was the start of the celebration. And then we had a whole weekend of activities. I was part of a panel discussion at the Washington Historical Society, and there were other discussion panels that went on. We marched with other people from around the country to the Capitol on Saturday. We had our own march, on Friday. And Saturday, we had a big parade, one of the biggest parades I've ever been in. It dovetailed with the Cherry Blossom Parade, which is a very large event in the district, which probably accounts for the fact that we had so many people. That ended with a big concert with some great local and national musicians and fireworks. You know, what's a celebration without fireworks? So So it was a pretty big deal, and a lot of people showed up. And because I'm an old geezer, I'm sore from marching and parading and all sorts of other things. But that's how we celebrated today, and it was a pretty big deal. And
kids
now
start your exercise regime.
Yeah, I know. I've got my Fitbit, but unfortunately, I'm not as fit as I should be. So I'm starting to work on it. Maybe I'll get emancipated. But let's get back to Mr. Gibbs and let's talk about the Civil War, Mr. Gibbs. Let's talk about the Civil War service and how this all dovetails into how it's associated with Emancipation Day.
Sure. One of the things that we have to remember is that part of the success, and it was a roller coaster. Abolition in D.C., which is seldom talked about, was a roller coaster. There was an anti-slavery society in the 1820s, and the flame flared and went out. I mean, it was just a combination of apathy and hostility. Even William Lloyd Garrison, the great abolitionist, sought to open a newspaper in the district because he considered this the first citadel of slavery to fall. He wanted it to happen in D.C. Again, he wasn't able to get his newspaper really off the ground. So this was hard territory. This was hard territory. It is critical that we understand that there was an oppressive system that existed in the District of Columbia. While we praise emancipation, we have to say a word or two about the activities of resistance that progressive whites and African Americans employed in terms of fighting back against the power of the slaveocracy, or as Senator Henry Wilson called it in his great masterwork, he called it the slave power. He is also a hero of D.C. emancipation. He died in the U.S. Capitol building just while finishing up that great book, which I commend to the inspection of the listeners. Again, it's called History of the Rise and Fall of the Slave Power. And Senator Henry Wilson is also the man who basically wrote the legislation to end the Black Code in D.C. And the Black community in the district never forgot his contributions, although he, too, has fallen a victim of historical amnesia in later times. But in one of my books, Black Copper and Bright, the District of Columbia's Black Civil War Regiment, I write about the connection between D.C. emancipation and the enlistment of Black men the following year in the district's colored regiment or district's colored infantry, and they were initially stationed at what is now Roosevelt Island. That is where, and I think there's finally a plaque or at least some mention of that unusual use of the island as a recruiting ground, a drill and ceremonies parade where the soldiers learn to fire their weapons. And so it's critical that we tie those forms of resistance, the soldiering, the loss of life endured by the men of the Black Regiment, the activities of the Underground Railroad in the district. Our listeners can pull up without cost on the Library of Congress website the narrative of a gentleman named Thomas Smallwood. I would have loved to have met him. He is frustrated at the difficulty of getting people on the Underground Railroad in Maryland and the district, how he has to basically charter wagons and teams of horses, and how he's often cheated by people who are seeking to make a profit off of the innately inhuman desire to be free. But he says at the same time in his narrative that the Black folks crowded upon him by the scores because they wanted his freedom. And one of the ways that they felt they could pay this off and demonstrate their natural manhood was to enlist in the district's colored regiment, which would be known as the 1st Regiment United States Colored Troops. Not because it was the first Black Civil War outfit. There were state units like the 54th Massachusetts. That's the unit shown in the movie Glory.
Right.
And there were other regiments, but this was the 1st Regiment. D.C.'s regiment was the 1st Regiment directly mustered into federal service. So it's important that we sort of weave together the Underground Railroad and the service of these men, many of whom were escaped fugitives from slavery outside of the district, as well as survivors of enslavement from the district. And that regiment would go on to fight in some of the toughest battles in the Civil War.
Let me just put in a plug here. If you come into Washington, D.C., former Councilman Frank Smith put together the African American Civil War Museum, and it really is worth going to see it. If you live in the district and you haven't visited it, you should. And if you come in from out of town to visit, it's one of those things that I don't think is on the regular tourist schedule, but it's really worth seeing.
It certainly is, and there are metal plaques surrounding the statue out in front of the museum that list 209,145 names of men of African descent. That's what the Union Army called them that served in the Civil War, and listed on a plaque is the 1st Regiment United States Colored Troops, the district's regiment. I'm honored to frequently lecture about the regiment in the various lecture series that I do in the area. We have one going on in Greenbelt coming up. That's every Tuesday at 11 Crescent Road and in Greenbelt at the Greenbelt Public Library. This Tuesday, the 19th, I'll be doing a book signing at the Howard University Bookstore from 5:30 to 7:30. One of the books I co-authored is called Black Georgetown Remembered, and it tracks the presence of people of African descent in one of the most well-known sections of the district, fancy Tony Georgetown. And this book is, this is 25th anniversary, and Georgetown University Press has, is pulling out all of the stops to celebrate the book's life.
How nice. Well,
yeah, I encourage people to go meet C.R. Gibbs. As you can tell by being on the show today, he's an amazing guy, and I'm sure the book is amazing, an amazing book. I'm going to have to try to get down there and get my signed copy to send to Maria.
Say, CR, do you have a website that people can track your comings and goings?
Yes. Thank Maria, thank you so much. My wife has given up on me. I get excited about this stuff, and I forget. People can go to portofharlem.net/cgibbs. Thank you, Maria. Thank you. Thank you. I would have missed
it. Well, because you've got so much going, I can't believe that you have a speaker series that meets weekly. I mean, I did that with Rotary for 2.5 years. I was the speaker's program person, and that was weekly. It's exhausting.
Yeah, but I do love it so, and I wouldn't trade it. We have a lecture series in Greenbelt on Tuesdays, and then on Wednesdays at the Woodridge Library right off of 18th. And Rhode Island Avenue Northeast. In fact, they're at the interim site, which is 1790 Douglas Street Northeast. And you can go on the website for the Woodridge Public Library. Do we have a moment? Can I bring up one final thing?
Yeah, please.
The slavery in the district has come back up in the public notice because of a major article in yesterday's New York Times. And it has to do with the sale by Georgetown University of 272 enslaved men, women, and children. For the last few years, people have been learning more and more about it. People could not believe that a university so well connected to the history of the city had actually engaged in the slave trade and had a huge sale in 1838. But part of this, even though the Pope had been encouraging them to let go of their enslaved population, it appears as though the main reason that it was finally done at Georgetown was because the university needed money. They had a tremendous need for hard cash. And what we know is that the majority of the funds that generated as a result of the sale went to putting out the financial fires that were licking around the edges of the ledger books at Georgetown University. Those enslaved people were sold into, despite promises, sold into vicious brutality. They could not practice the Catholic faith. And it's kind of interesting when you think about it. The Jesuit priests made them pray on the plantations, but at the same time, they were often beaten. And then they try to erect some sort of agreement with the new slave owners, allow them to, and they're not in plantations anywhere near a Catholic church. So if for people who want to read more about it, it's in the April 16th New York Times, and it's entitled 272 Slaves Were Sold to Save Georgetown. What Does It Owe Their Descendants?
Yeah, wow. I mean, where were the Jesuits, at that time? I had a few Jesuit instructors in my day, and that
did
I find
you?
That really shocking. Yeah, I went to Catholic school in for a little while, but
I do. I went for 12 years, but I always had the nuns because I went to all girls Catholic high school. But Pope Francis is a Jesuit, so there's definitely hope with the iteration that it's coming of of maturity now.
Well, I always had a lot of nuns too, Maria, and I always had the Mary whatever who checked off on the employment application does not like children. My experience is that I always got the ones with the ruler and the bad attitude.
My experience as well, Senator, that I went to a school across the street from Hine. They torn it down. It was St. Anne's Convent. And connected with the Josephite order of priests and a group of black nuns that situated in Baltimore. But boy, were they fast on the rulers.
Yeah.
They
See,
were.
That missed me. My dad has the scars in his knuckles from the nuns when he was growing up in Chicago. Yeah. But that corporal punishment was outdated by the time I got into the system.
Well, I don't want to digress too much, but you know, it always amazed me that you had these you know, women that were given this responsibility, and then you truss them up in about 80 pounds worth of wool clothing, and you put them in a classroom with 28 kids and no air conditioning. You know, I'm amazed that they even survived.
I had 50 in my class. How did you have such small classes?
I don't know.
We had 50 in two classrooms for each grade. So my grade school, first through eighth grade, had 800 students.
Wow. I guess...
We do digress, so let's get back to
CR. Yeah, we got off on the nun track, and we could stay there all day. But CR, how do you see Emancipation Day? How did that affect the development of the District of Columbia? Do you think it affected it in positive or negative ways? Most people know that since the 1960s, the majority population in Washington, D.C. has been African American, but that was 100 years later. So did it have an impact, brought more African Americans to Washington, or what do you think the significance of Emancipation Day is in the, you know, the development of the city?
On the eve of Emancipation Day, the Board of Aldermen, the, if you will, the great-great-granddaddy of the city council, issued a resolution basically saying that emancipation was going to turn D.C. into an asylum of free Negroes, a population undesirable in every part of the country. And in fact, the population, now in 1860, there were about 14,000 African Americans in the district. By 1870, that population more than doubles, nearly triples. And in other words, 30,000, between 30 and 40,000 African Americans come into the DMV that weren't there before. Mm-hmm. And their work and the desire to build homes immeasurably affects not only the population, but also the economic structure. Mm-hmm. But D.C. is a tough place to be in a city that has already made it clear it doesn't want you. When the Board of Aldermen says, this is what we think of free Negroes, and it's only 1862, you can imagine the difficult circumstances that appertain from 1862 and in a city that we believe, you know, that we lost the vote in part because the Congress did not like the idea of seeing black folk involved in the city government, in the House of Delegates and so forth. So in order to basically drive a stake through the heart of black political aspirations, white folk had the vote taken away from them, consequently away from black people, and we had the advent of the Board of Commissioners. And this ricochets. I was asked 2 years ago to write a booklet on the path to home rule by the Office of the Secretary, and I ended it by saying in 1894, when the right to vote had been stripped away for more than a decade and a half, the original Washington Times newspaper carried an article entitled "These Men Desire to Vote." The article reported that local labor leaders considered it, quote, high time for restoration of the vote, unquote. And the article ends with the comments of Joseph K. Potter, Secretary of the Federation of Labor, quote, it is the inalienable right of every American citizen. The Constitution of the United States is founded on equity and justice, and the privilege of suffrage is guaranteed to every citizen, unquote.
Well, and you know, our first delegate, Walter Fauntleroy, actually wasn't, as you know, not actually our first delegate, but our first delegate in modern times.
Yes.
Used to say, you know, that we were too liberal, we were too black, we were too Democrat, and we were too urban, and that was our problem. So he certainly recognized, and Senator Kennedy used to repeat that all the time as well, that the racial makeup of the District of Columbia really did stand in the way of our getting equal voting rights. And we know from the history of the way statehood, which is our goal these days, has evolved. We know through incidences like New Mexico, where it took so long for them to become a state after they applied for statehood, and they only got accepted, their petition for statehood only got accepted after they became a majority white population. So we've known for a long time that race has been a factor. And it
shouldn't be. You think still in this day?
I think I'll just say that.
Yeah, you can be, you can still be, a jurisdiction can be too black or too brown, and the gears of government sort of slow down. And so I do believe that, and I think, you know, it. I'm watching it, and I'm wondering to see how the bankruptcy of Puerto Rico, there's such a thing as a fast track and a slow track, and I wait to see how those issues will affect what a government action takes for Puerto Rico.
Well, that's interesting.
What's your guess? Do you think, CR?
I think that things will, given the congressional mood right now, I do not think it will be, how shall we say, moved along as expeditiously as it could be if the complexion of Puerto Rico were different. I'm sorry. Wow. That's one of the lessons that my study of history teaches me. And we'll head. I love to be wrong. That's why they put erasers on pencils. But I'm, at this point, I expect our friends of a certain party to do everything they can to delay and to deny it. I hope I'm wrong. I've been to Puerto Rico, love the folk, and they deserve. And if we can bail out the auto industry, I can't understand why we. Well, let me leave that alone. But it just seems that. In a manner of fairness, that we ought to do what we can to protect and preserve Puerto Rico.
Well, and you know, I don't know if you've even seen these yet, CR, but there's commercials. I saw one the other day that are saying, don't bail out Puerto Rico. Yeah. They're already running commercials.
Yeah. This is part of the difference between, you know, we had Lee Iacocca, for those of folk who remember who he was. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we've got to save Chrysler. We've got to save GM. Okay, but we're just going to extinguish Puerto Rico? How does that work? I just don't think it's fair.
Well, you know,
well, having visited there myself also, you close your eyes, you know, or say you wake up, you don't know that you're not in the United States.
Yeah,
the signs and the traffic and the everything is just like us. I still don't quite understand what's the deal, but I guess maybe Michael, you could be an advisor to them, consultant to them about statehood.
I don't know. They've had a confusing plebiscite election a few years ago where they for the first time have opted for statehood. So we talk to them a lot, but we know that there are encumbrances, as CR points out, to their movement that may, you know, that have some impact on our movement, but they're different. They would get five congressmen, five representatives, for example, given the size of their population. So mm-hmm. we'll have to have CR back to talk about this because we've run out of time.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Darn. And I want to thank you, CR, for being on. Please, Mr. Gibbs, one more time, give people your website.
Yes.
Sure. Port of Harlem. And that's the Harlem as in New York City. portofharlem.net/CGibbs.
Terrific.
Well, thank you so much for being on our show.
Yes.
We
it was
hope
fascinating.
To come back. And Loretta Carter Haynes, if you know, and Peter Haynes, her son, who have fought for this to keep this day alive too. Thank you so much, Vincent Orange, C.R. Gibbs, and all you taxpayers out there that get an extra day, extra 3 days actually, because of the people of the District of Columbia and Emancipation Day. I hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you next week. Maria, you have the last word.
As always, it's an honor and a privilege to be with you, Michael. Thank you for the opportunity, and I hope everyone has a great week. I have finals starting tomorrow, so I'm going to be really happy when this week is finished.
We'll keep our fingers crossed.
Thank you.
Good luck, Maria, on your finals.
Thank you, CR.
Sure.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Give the people their right to vote.